Today's program was brought to you by Roth Cheese, a pioneer in the U.S. specialty cheese movement. For more information, visit rothcheese.com.
Season 2 of Meetin' 3 is almost here. We're kicking off with a show all about football.
I am excited. It's so much fun.
We'll tell you how to master the tailgating scene with help from some Atlanta chefs.
The sky's the limit when it comes to tailgating.
Yeah, do something that you can pull off without stressing yourself too much.
Then we'll look at what's good and bad about players' diets, whether they're an NFL star or just made the JV team at their high school.
And that's when I was told the first time, well, just take them to McDonald's and feed Big Macs and milkshakes.
There's a greater percentage of guys that have a clear focus on what they're putting in their body.
You know, in SEC school, people are fans, but we also have to realize that they're kids. They're 18 to 22, 23-year-olds.
Subscribe to Meetin' 3 wherever you listen to podcasts and be the first to know when Season 2 drops.
This is Dana Cowan, and you are listening to Speaking Broadly on Heritage Radio Network. Each week, I interview someone in the food world on their journey to success, their challenges along the way, to figure out what it is that we can learn from them and share with them. Today, my guest is a very successful San Francisco restaurateur and chef, and most recently, she has added cookbook author to all that, along with her husband. We're going to be talking today about love, food, and money, which is almost as good as love, sex, and money. Some people might think it's better than love, sex, and money, although I don't think I know those people. But so welcome, Sarah Rich from Rich Table in San Francisco. So happy to have you here in the studio with me.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
So I'm going to start out by talking about flirting.
Sure.
Yeah, flirting is it's a good topic. It's actually now almost a toxic topic in the workplace. But back in the day, flirting wasn't a bad thing. And it is the beginning of your love story with your now husband, Evan. So all that flirting worked out well. What's your point of view on flirting?
Well, I do think to some extent it is a very natural part of the experience. I mean, at least it was in my time coming up as a line cook. You know, it's a very high stress, very intense environment, and it is an easy way to blow off a little steam and have a little fun.
So tell me, you were working at Boulay at the time.
Yes.
Which was an extraordinary restaurant with an extraordinary chef, very brainy, detailed, delicious, ahead of its time food. Mm-hmm. And you were in charge in some way. Mm-hmm. What were you doing at Boulay?
So when I started out, I was an extern. I was going to the French Culinary Institute, and I was going a couple of nights a week after class. And when I graduated, I ended up being offered a position, and I started out in Garmanger and then moved over to the fish station, and eventually was the chef de partie of the fish station. And that is the time when Evan, my now husband, started working.
And what was Evan doing when he got there?
Well, he originally started at the Danube, which was next door. It was Boulay's Austrian restaurant. Evan wanted to work at Boulay, but there wasn't space, but they did have space at the Danube, but only in the pastry department. So originally he started in the pastry department, and he worked with, the chef was Austrian and his sous chef was German, and they would just speak German to each other all day. So everybody just sort of assumed that Evan was German.
he also wasn't talking.
No,
as I
he
understand.
Wasn't talking. He just kept his head down. As you do, you're taught, you know, just keep your head down and work. Don't talk. Don't strike up a conversation unless you're spoken to. So we just all assumed that he was German or Austrian. Until one day, our now business partner, Jonathan Gilbert, went up to him and was like, "Where are you from?"
Slowly, from, distinctly.
Yes, I'm from Jersey. And that changed everything.
So, you know, what was that first spark? Like, was it the way he, you know, rolled the dough? Was it... Because I chef's hands can be quite extraordinary.
It's true. I think, you know, of course there was, I thought he was really cute. But also, I think there was something to that, you know, focus, keeping his head down. You know, I respected that approach to his work. And I think, you know, that can be sort of a turn on in its own way. So
I think that's right. It's sort of like a nerdy girl version of
yes.
cute, you know? It's
yes.
not like, well, he was the one who was left standing at the yes. end of the night. It's like, no, he was like quiet and focused. Yeah. And
a hard worker.
A hard worker.
And, you know, trying very hard. And, you know, that made an impression on me for sure.
So you guys worked together for a while, although separately. Mm-hmm. I love the story about how you were absolutely discouraged from even
yes.
talking to each other.
Yes, it made for a very interesting work experience.
So we were given different shifts and...
Yeah, so when we first started dating, it's not like we put it out there. We just, you know, we would just meet up if we had the same night off. And then at some point, the chef de cuisine found out. I sort of told him, kind of jokingly, not really thinking it would be a big deal. And he immediately put the kibosh on that. He was not having it. He freaked out and was like, Chef Boulay would be so angry. He doesn't want these things happening in his kitchen, which, I mean, now as a business owner, I kind of understand that perspective.
I'm curious how you do feel about it, you know, right now, because you have, how many people are in your kitchen right now? Or
Something like 20
yes.
or so. And we do have, you know, at the time when I was working at Boulay, I was one of the only women, but, you know, not so in our kitchen. We have a lot of women that, you know, go through our doors. It is different. As once you become the owner, there are a lot of things that you see that, you know, when you were a young cook, you didn't understand why this rule was in place or this policy was in place. And now as a business owner, you're like, okay, yes, because you have to protect yourself and you have to protect your employees.
Right. The line crossing can
yes.
be bad.
Yes.
The beautiful love story happened,
yes.
and indeed, even different schedules and
yes,
shifts
we made
could
it,
not
you know,
give you.
We made it work, and that has been a theme in our lives since then. You know, you find a way.
That's so true when I think about your crazy schedules now.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it could be nothing compared to, mm-hmm. you know, back in the day. At least you're married now.
Yeah, I mean, it's actually true that all of those things have helped us to understand, you know, our place now and what it takes to follow your dream and do what you love. You know, at the time when we were just dating, it would require, you know, Evan would come home at the end of his shift. He would go all the way from Tribeca to my apartment in Queens, so he wouldn't get there until like 3 a.m. I would wake up at 3 a.m. just so we could spend some time together. And then, you know, I would leave at 6 a.m. to get to Tribeca by 7:30 for my morning shift. And that, you know, that's what you did. And so now, I don't mean to be insensitive, but when we have cooks who are like, I have to have my day off with my girlfriend or my boyfriend, I'm like, what are you talking about? You're talking right. to somebody who never had a day off. Like,
right.
Evan and I didn't have a consistent, specific day off together until we were actually already married, you know, and moved to California. So
did you ever think, like, I'm not sure I know you well enough to, you know, because we don't actually spend a lot of time together.
Right. Well, we worked at the same time. And
yeah.
that's how you can really learn who yeah. a person is.
Right. That's
sure.
Some people have the travel test. Like, if I can travel to Europe with them or Botswana, I'm
yes.
sure I can marry them. And you're
yes.
like, if I can work with him, I'm pretty sure I can be married to him.
Yes. Yeah. Absolutely.
And so you took a really big risk because
yes.
you left New York
mm-hmm.
and you were choosing between West Coast cities. It seems
mm-hmm.
like you were shopping. You weren't exactly, you know, like Amazon, but
right.
And you chose San Francisco.
Yeah.
But it sounded like it was really hard. You guys were really broke.
It was really hard. It was, you know, we had been married for about 3 months, and right about the time that we were about to get married, I just sort of said, you know, I'd been living in New York for 8 years. Evan is from out here. He grew up in New Jersey, born in Queens, and his whole family has stayed here. I mean, like, his aunts and uncles and cousins either live in Queens or Connecticut, or, you know, this is where they are. And my family is not like that. I grew up in Texas and Louisiana, and my parents lived in Utah for a while. You know, they got around, and my sister is out in LA. And I just knew that I didn't want to spend forever in New York. And I knew we were getting married at some point. We'd start a family. We'd want to build a restaurant. And all of that is permanence. You know, you kind of, once you've got all that, you're sort of staying where you are. And I wanted to explore a little bit. So I convinced Evan to take a chance. And we decided to put everything we owned in storage. We bought one-way tickets to LA. And we said, let's try to figure out a place to live. We'll give it a year. If we hate it, we can always move back. And I mean, it was hard for a lot of reasons. Evan took a chance, but he didn't necessarily want to. Oh.
How did you convince him? Like, what is the way to, you know, show someone the other point of view well enough,
right,
that they sacrifice their own point of view?
Well, I think I said all that. You know, before I had met him, the furthest west he'd ever been was Chicago. And I took him out before we got married in Santa Fe. My parents were living in Santa Fe at the time. And, you know, I took him out there. We went on a long drive. We drove through the Grand Canyon. We saw this, you know, part of the country that he'd never seen. And I think it sparked something that he sort of wanted to explore a little bit. And he's a risk taker. You know, if he weren't, we would never have opened our restaurants.
Maybe you wouldn't be together. I think you said that your parents aren't really risk takers.
Not in that way. You know, like they wouldn't. I mean, they've taken risks, you know, in the sense of moving to a place they didn't know, but mm-hmm. they would never open a small business on their own, you know.
What do you think gave you that confidence that you could open a small business, or the vision in your own mind, which had been, you know, really seeded there since you went to culinary school?
Yeah,
to do this.
I think I'd always sort of wanted to open a restaurant. Even when I was little, I used to beg. My dad's a doctor, my mom's a nurse, and I would beg them to leave their jobs and open a restaurant. I just wanted my dad to be the chef and my mom to run the front of the house, and I would be the waitress. And
how do you even come up with that dream as a child?
I don't know. I always loved the experience of going to restaurants, and I loved, you know, the hospitality of it. And I love, you know, people always ask, what do you love about cooking? And some people love, like Evan loves the adrenaline of it. I love sharing. You know, I know it's a very feminine way to put it, but I love creating something and then sharing it with people and watching them experience it.
So what type of restaurants did you go to when you were growing up?
You know, restaurants were usually like a special treat. Mm-hmm. You know, now we go to restaurants all the time, but when I was growing up, it was definitely a special treat, like somebody's birthday or graduation or, and I grew up in small towns. I grew up in Shreveport, Louisiana and Lubbock, Texas, where I went to high school. So it's not like we had a lot of really, you know, interesting places to choose from, but there was usually, you know, one fancy French restaurant or something like that, that would be the special place that we would choose to go on those occasions.
It's always interesting to me because, you know, depending on the food that you eat, mm-hmm. As you grow up, it shapes what you think the possibilities are, mm-hmm. you know, and you've, your possibilities are so much grander and more open mm-hmm. from going to culinary school, coming east and then bringing it west. Did you develop a palate? Like, do you love, you know, barbecue? Is there something that you hold on to from?
Oh, for sure. All of that stuff. I mean, I couldn't eat like that every day, especially now as I get older. But yeah, all of those things. I mean, that's why, you know, at our new restaurant, RT Rotisserie, we have a fried chicken sandwich. On the weekends, we do fried chickens because I grew up with my grandmother. We would go to her farm in Texas. And, you know, the Saturday afternoon meal would be her fried chicken. And then we'd sit on the back porch and, you know, churn her lemon ice cream in the old school, you know, salt ice cream churner. Mm-hmm. So things like that, you know, definitely still are very special to me and are flavors that I look for, you know.
It sounds so romantic. And I think, you know, there are a lot of people that I know and a lot of people who are in this business who had a family who, you know, were on farms, ran farms, and this next generation, that's, you know, I wonder what that shift will be like when people don't have that memory. Yeah. And the memory is going to restaurants. It's actually much more foodie than it was, but mm-hmm. it's not about where food came from. Yeah. I think that'll be a really interesting switch. So you guys chose San Francisco, but your stuff was...
Yes.
Back east.
Yes.
And you had nothing with you.
Yeah.
Plus no money. Tell me about that.
Well, so my brother was living in Mountain View, which is south of San Francisco on the peninsula. It's about 45 minutes south. And he was living in a small apartment at the time with his wife, and they had a 2-year-old, and his wife was about 8 months pregnant. So we were staying with him, sleeping on his couch, and we would pay them back by, you know, cooking dinner for them every night. And
that's pretty good payback, actually.
Yeah,
I gotta say.
Yeah,
personal chef. Sure, you could have a room.
Exactly, it worked out pretty well for them. But then we eventually, once we decided to stay in the Bay Area, we found a place to live in San Francisco. We headed up there. We found a place in the Mission, and I guess it just didn't occur to me that it would take forever for our stuff to arrive. So I called the moving company.
Oh my gosh!
And they're like, okay, yeah, we'll be there in about a month. So we had a month figure out, you know, still living out of our suitcases.
Yeah.
We were on a fourth floor walk up and all we had was an air mattress that we had no money at this time. We had negative money. We had had to borrow money from our parents in order to, you know, figure out, like, when we were driving up and down the coast of California and Oregon and going up to Seattle, trying to figure out where we wanted to live. We were sleeping in rest stops because we didn't want to pay $50 for a motel for the night. You know, we had nothing. So we scrounged.
How does that feel? Like, is there something freeing about it? It's like, or is it just terrifying?
It's both.
Yeah.
You know, it is kind of, I think a lot of people, when they are in that age, in their 20s, they do these things that, or, you know, they have these experiences. I know my parents did. I know my grandparents did.
Really?
That I think they kind of...
What did your parents and grandparents do? That's so interesting.
Well, they, you know, I know, like, so when I would have these tough times and think about how broke we were and are we ever going to be able to make rub two pennies together and be able to live somewhere outside of a tiny apartment and an air mattress. And I'd call my dad and sort of talk to him about it. I remember he sent me this letter that, you know, was encouraging. And I know this is a hard time and you'll get through this and you're going to figure out your path. And he was like, your grandparents, when they first started dating and they met like in elementary school in South Dakota.
Oh my God.
And they were
broke.
That's
amazing.
Yeah. And he was like, when they first started dating, they would save all week up a dime. Then they would go to Sears and their date was they would just walk around Sears and like window shop and just look at things. And then they would go take that dime to the ice cream shop and buy an ice cream. And that was their date. You know, and by the time they passed away, they, you know, they weren't like wealthy, but they had made a life for themselves. My grandfather had his own auto body shop. Like they had found success. And I still think about that today, that, you know, people can have these moments that are really trying, but that's how you sort of find who you are and you will get through it.
Yes, I wonder whether people who glide through
right.
ever find the same sort of satisfaction that people who just didn't glide through can have.
And that's why, you know, getting back to, I never want to seem like I don't have empathy towards, you know, the 20-year-old young line cook who's struggling and working hard and has a small paycheck and, you know. But it's like, this is the time in your life to do that. This is when you're grinding, and this is when you're building that character and building that experience, you know.
And what about eating on the road, like, or eating on so little money? You know, your choices are so limited.
Yes. Well, we did. I don't know that it's the best advice, but we did definitely pull out the credit card to charge some stuff, you know, because, I mean, that is part of the experience and trying to figure out where we wanted to live and places we might want to work and, you know, what the culinary scene was like wherever we were looking, whether it be Portland or Seattle or San Francisco. So we would find restaurants that we had heard about or read about and try them out and sort of, that's where the credit card came in.
And did you choose your location in part because of the Beacon restaurants or because of the scene? Like, it just seems, you know, that you're going to, your goal, I would imagine, is to find a place to fit in, be different,
right?
But be surrounded by
right.
Colleagues who are interesting. And
yeah, I mean, I think any of those, like the main cities we went to, Portland, Seattle, San Francisco, any of them could have been the right city. And in fact, we loved Portland. We had a really hard time deciding between Portland and San Francisco. We actually sat down and did the old school, you know, positive and negative of each one and tried to narrow it down. And I think we ultimately decided that San Francisco had the most potential and the most, we could do more. You know, Portland still seemed a little isolated to us. And
do you think do you think that list thing makes sense? And if you've done it once in your life, have you done it for other things?
Yeah.
Does it work out?
I think it does make sense. However, I also think that a lot of times you already know what the answer is, and you're going to find a way to make that the answer no matter what. So you may look at the pros and cons, and there are actually more cons, but you've already made that decision for yourself that you want to go for it anyway, so you're going to do it anyway.
Right, it's a weighted list.
Yes.
It's like, well, there's only four things on this side, but they're each worth 25 points.
Right.
And all those things on the other side, they're only worth 1 point apiece.
Right,
I mean, in that mental math, that crazy, I mean, I'm a huge Gilmore Girls fan, and you know, Rory was all about the lists, and I love a good list too, but I agree that, you know, you do know.
Yeah.
I mean, you, and if you don't know, then you probably should even just throw the whole thing out, start again. Like if you truly have no idea, nothing seems sort of natural. But you also ate, I mean, I feel like there was fast food involved.
Oh, I'm sure there was. Yes.
But, and I'm wondering, cause it's hard as a person who loves food to like go down that road.
Yes. Well, luckily on the West Coast, we do have things like In-N-Out. So you can find some okay stuff there.
That's funny. And then you began a Rich Table as a series of pop-ups. Were you at the beginning wave of pop-ups? Because I think you were.
Yes.
Right? It's not a thing that people were doing. How did you even have that idea? Because it really wasn't so out there.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I guess it was out there enough that we knew enough to try it, but it wasn't so much that, you know, there became a point where just everyone was doing a pop-up every week, you know, every week. Every restaurant was, you know, somebody was showing up to do something. And it wasn't quite that big of a thing, but it was enough that we knew that it could be a way to, you know, get people to know who we are. Because, you know, you can open a restaurant, but if people don't, if they can't connect you to something, they're not necessarily going to come. And just saying that you worked at X restaurant and Y restaurant isn't necessarily enough. And so we thought it was important to at least get San Francisco to sort of understand who our names, what our names were. And so we found a couple of restaurants that, you know, they had one night a week that they were closed and they, you know, were open to the idea of letting us take over their kitchen for the night. So that's what we did.
And was that an immediate success and people found you and...
Yeah, it did. It actually went pretty well. We had a couple of friends who were in the PR field who we were able to sort of use their help to kind of, you know, send the word out to this person or that person. So there were a few press people that showed up, which is really, you know, really important and really great that that happened. And sometimes in the moment you don't realize how powerful that is or how lucky you are to be able to make that happen, but it definitely helped. For sure.
So we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about the restaurant Rich Table. We're going to talk about this amazing, beautiful book, same name, no confusion there, and being a mom, a wife, and making choices that maybe you didn't expect to make it all work. So stay with us. We'll be right back.
Today's program was brought to you by Roth Cheese, a pioneer in the U.S. specialty cheese movement. Roth is in its 25th year of making specialty cheese in the rolling hills of southern Wisconsin. With strong Swiss heritage, Roth is best known for its award-winning Alpine-style cheeses under the name Grand Cru. Fresh Wisconsin milk, combined with expertise in affinage, is how Roth creates high-quality, great-tasting cheese year after year. In 2016, hard work paid off when out of over 2,000 contenders, Roth Grand Cru Sirchois was named world champion at the World Cheese Championship. For more information, visit rothcheese.com.
Oh, Welcome back. This is your host, Dana Cowan. You're listening to Speaking Broadly, and my guest today is Sarah Rich from Rich Table. So we've been talking about her journey to opening this restaurant, which involved taking a lot of risks, falling in love in an unusual, well, maybe not such an unusual situation, but falling in love and with someone trying to keep them apart. But now we get to, I think that's all the good part because that's how you figured out where you are today. Yeah. But what a wonderful place you're in right now. So you did a bunch of pop-ups, but then you opened this restaurant. I was looking at your Kickstarter campaign, which is still there.
I know it is.
Which is kind of cool, you know, that you can look at something that was from, I think it was 2012.
Yes.
Yeah. And, you know, you won to raise $15,000 mm-hmm. and you raised like $16,324. So did that Kickstarter campaign, like, was that icing on the cake or did you actually start with like $16,000?
No. Oh my God, no.
I'm kidding. But, yeah.
That would be amazing. We'd be talking about more. We had gotten some funding, but then we needed, you know, at the last minute, there's always like some electrical work that you didn't anticipate or, you know, this contractor charged a little bit more for whatever. And so we needed a little bit extra money. But it was also, to be honest, it was, you know, we just had a small group of investors, only a couple, but we had a lot of friends and family that wanted to be able to contribute something, but they, you know, they couldn't necessarily contribute a huge amount or they didn't know how to contribute. So, you know, we needed that money, but we also really wanted to give people an opportunity to help out in any way they
and
could.
To be part of it. It's sort of like wedding gifts, except exactly. it was opening a restaurant. And in so much of the press that I've read, the definition of the restaurant, like mm-hmm. what is it?
Right.
It's hard.
It is hard.
You know, so many people have one sentence. It's like it's a Japanese izakaya with, you know, whatever. There's a lot of easy ways to define things. Right. And I feel like you guys never reverted to that. And I wonder, was that a struggle? And what are your seven words now?
So when we first were putting together the restaurant and when we were, you know, pitching it to people or else when we were already, you know, about to open and you talk to the various publications and people want to know what kind of restaurant? That's the first question. And we were always like, I don't know. We don't have a concept.
Right. For press people, we hate that. Why are they talking to us? They don't even know what their restaurant
is.
Yeah.
People did not like it at all.
Yeah.
But we didn't have a concept. We were just like, I don't know, it's a good food restaurant. So, you know, trust us. So, you know, eventually we just started saying, I don't know. We go to the market, we see what's good, and we cook it. And that has been our motto ever since.
And that's enough for people.
Yeah, and I think what it did was people, you know, on the one hand, it made it more difficult because people didn't really know what they were getting themselves into. But on the other hand, it has really let the restaurant sort of evolve and define itself on its own. So that, you know, people, you know, all we wanted people to do was trust us, come in and just experience it. And that's what they do now. You know, they are comfortable with the idea that they don't necessarily know what they're going to get. And I don't mean that like in an intimidating or overwhelming way. They know that it's going to be a good meal. They know it's going to be sort of like California inspired. But they also, you know, there can be flavors from all different angles. You know, it's anything. Which is still not really a definition.
It's not. I mean, it's the notion of having a community, and it's the food community too, because the food community loves Rich Table, mm-hmm. me among them. But we love things in boxes.
Right.
And to just be that open, you're so right. Because when I look at, you know, the menu today or the recipes in the book versus the couple of meals that I had mm-hmm. And the things that were signature dishes and really mm-hmm. important at the time, the porcini donuts, are the porcini donuts mm-hmm. still on the...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, they have to be, right? There's a couple of things that probably cannot move.
Yes.
But there's been a lot of shaping and reshaping.
Yeah.
So I'm interested in this notion. I'm actually interested in every sphere. But how does the restaurant become its truest self where, you know, it's what you want, but it's also feedback from the... guests.
Right. Well, that is really important. And that is something that we definitely not just struggled with, but also made something that was really important to us is, and I think more chefs should do it. You know, you have to listen to the guest on some level. You have to appreciate the feedback.
But so what have they suggested to you that you're like, God, that's not really what I wanted to do, but I'll keep doing it for you or else, you know.
Well, so when we first opened, the menu was the same structure. You know, we've got the bites, appetizers, pasta, entree. But the way that it was meant to be order, the way you were meant to eat was, you know, all the portions were a little bit smaller than they are now. And you were meant to sort of have your own tasting menu. So you'd kind of order one thing from each section and then experience like a tasting menu without kind of the
pomp.
Yeah, exactly. And people didn't get it at all. And, you know, that was a point where we could have said, no, that's how the menu is designed. That's the expectation. We're not changing this. But, you know, we listened to them. We realized, like, the smaller portions, it just, something was not connecting. So we changed. We don't do that anymore. Bigger portions, a little more expensive because they're bigger portions. But now people just order however they want. And it's completely changed the dynamic. And people, nobody has a problem with it. And totally works.
So when you opened, were you, because your culinary background is so strong, right? We talked about Boulay. Mm-hmm. We didn't talk about Moss Farmhouse, which you opened, or Michael Mina, for whom you worked. And you have a really deep, deep resume. When you opened, were you and Evan cooking side by side?
Mm-hmm. When we first opened, we worked on the menu, you know, the culinary side of the savory side of the menu together. And I also did the desserts because everywhere I've ever worked, I've worked pastry for a little bit. Just because from my perspective, it makes you more well-rounded. You have more to draw from.
So that's important.
I think it's really important.
And why is that important?
I mean, the more you understand about cooking, the more you know what to draw from. You know,
there is a lot of crossover in your food, though, isn't there? In the rich table food,
yeah.
I mean, there's
sure.
a lot of fruit in the savory. There's, mm-hmm. There's also a lot of experimentation.
Yeah, for sure. And I think all of those, like, I think savory can work well in a sweet application. I think sweet can work well in a savory application. You know, if you do it right, if you have the right balance. But so when we opened Rich Table, I did the desserts as well, and then, you know, as time moved on, it just, the schedule, considering, you know, we had one child at the time, now we have two, it was just more, it worked better with my schedule to exclusively do the pastries, so I started doing that.
And I feel like you gave something up.
Yeah.
Do you feel like you gave something up?
Yeah, that was definitely, it was a very challenging time to do that, because, you know, when you are a woman cook, people always assume you're in pastry. I mean, everybody always wanted to know if I was the pastry cook or like the hostess. No, I'm a line cook. I'm a cook. And so it has nothing, like, there's nothing against pastry and women in pastry, but it was very important for me that people understood I wasn't the pastry cook. And then to suddenly be the pastry cook, I mean, that was hard. And it was a hard, it was definitely hard, you know, with my relationship with Evan, because, you know, then now we're in this sort of classic role of the guy is the chef and the wife is the pastry chef. And that was very frustrating for me. And, you know, I don't think Evan really understood that for a while, because you don't, if you're not the one experiencing it, it doesn't necessarily make sense to you.
And I'm sure in some way the two of you are so bonded, you create the dishes together.
Right.
You exchange ideas all the time, mm-hmm. but you achieved so much. Mm-hmm. And then it's, again, not that pastry isn't amazing, but it's a redefinition of self.
Right.
It's more that than
yes.
the role. So how did you deal with sort of coming to terms with accepting that and then hopefully, you know, feeling good about that redefining? Like, how did you recalibrate?
I fought it a lot.
You did, yeah.
I did. I fought it a lot. And I was pretty bitter about it for a while. And it's hard because, you know, like from Evan's perspective, he's like, but your desserts are great and you're getting recognized for them and people really love them. And I remember I got, one year I got a Best New Chef, a Best New Pastry Chef Award, Food and Wine. And I couldn't get out of bed that day. And I know that sounds so bizarre, but it wasn't that I was disappointed. I was amazed, but I was also like, there are so many great pastry chefs who have trained for years to do this. And also, I couldn't figure out who I was. I was very thrown off by that. You know, it was this great honor, but also I just didn't know how to take it. So it's definitely been very hard for me. And I think I'm only just now, I mean, Rich Table is about 6.5 years old. Mm-hmm. And I kind of am just now sort of comfortable with it because, you know, it's okay to sort of redefine who you are and to create a new, experience for yourself. I don't know. I still can't even put it in words, really.
But I can imagine because you had a vision from when you were little.
Yeah.
And you powered through it.
Yes.
And there was so much hard work.
Yes.
And the hard work was actually not in pastry.
Yes. And a lot of hard work of proving yourself,
right.
You know, that I can do this just like any guy can do it. And then...
Did it seem too easy, this pastry thing? Like, did it feel to you unearned or...
I think some, yeah, because I worked pastry here and there for people for a couple of months at a time, but I didn't, and even still, like, if you asked me to go do some classic pastry, I wouldn't know how to do it. I just know how to put desserts together in a way that tastes good to me or have, you know, like, I like a certain texture, or a saltiness, or, you know, I just do what I think tastes good. But I don't have a lot of, you know, this classic training behind me.
Do you think that the pastry position should be more recognized? Because pastry is in a very complex state in America, at least from where I sit, which is you have to be either a big restaurant to have pastry.
Yeah.
It's the first thing that gets cut in a downturn.
Mm-hmm.
You can buy so much pastry. You can... have someone, you know, it's an easier thing to supplement. It's a big salary,
yes.
Or it's a salary to pay. Do you feel like, what do you feel about the state of pastry in America?
I mean, I think all of that is definitely true. I mean, even at Rich Table, like, we've had periods here and there where we've hired people to come in and take over, like, especially when I had our second child, mm-hmm. We had to have somebody who came in, and she, you know, had way more sort of classic training than I did. But her desserts were also very different from what I would do. And from, I think, like, they were great for the time, but they also weren't quite Rich Table.
Well, seems like they didn't have that same personality because they don't come from the same place.
Right.
The restaurant's such an integrated vision.
Yeah. But I mean, I think it is unfortunate that we tend to not think of pastry in quite the same way that we think of savory. And I'm as guilty of that as anybody, because it is very challenging in its own way.
But why do you think, like, why is it? I mean, just we're talking about this and like, wait, why is that? And then, because it obviously played into, well, it's a piece of the struggle that you had. Why isn't pastry as respect? I mean, I feel like I should be able to answer this question myself, but why isn't pastry afforded the same respect?
I don't know. I mean, maybe it's because, I mean, what percentage of pastries in a restaurant get ordered anyway? You know, like...
That's true. That's 100% true.
Yeah.
Right? It's not essential to the meal.
Yeah. It is not something that everybody gets. And so, you know, the majority of the focus is on the savory side of the menu, and the dessert is sort of like the... I mean, unless you're going in there to have... the pastry of some, you know, very well-recognized pastry chef.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's one thing. But most places are not like that.
At Food & Wine, when we were doing Best New Pastry Chef, there were days that I would travel around, like, a city only going for dessert,
mm-hmm.
which is not a really great... You know, I've done tastings of savory food that way, and it's fine. Doing that for dessert is, you know... It's a sugar rush of an experience. It's not quite as satisfying. And also, you have to, with Best New Chefs, we would never tell anyone we were there.
Yeah.
With Best New Pastry, we feel like pastry is so regimented
mm-hmm.
that you could tell a pastry chef they can't switch their dessert. I mean, they could put an extra strawberry, but it's really different from the what happens on the savory side. So, you know, we would call in advance, go, we just want to come for dessert. We wouldn't really tell people why. And they're like, really? What kind of weird journey are you on? But okay. And everybody was, you know, very kind. But did it ever seem like an option to have, you know, you do 3 days on savory and Evan do 3 days, whatever, 3 days on savory? Is that bad for the restaurant?
Well, I also think it's hard, you know, to create recipes and ideas and dishes and all of those things. I mean, for me anyway, it requires a lot of focus and attention. And so to sort of, you know, go between back and forth, and to me, it's my mind needs to be in one place. It can't mm-hmm. be in all these different places. But it's funny you mention that, because Evan and I were walking down the street yesterday, and he was like, you know, maybe when we get back, I'll go work pastry for a while and start putting some desserts on the menu. And I was like, all right, feel free. Have fun.
You're welcome to my side of the kitchen. Because that would be, I mean, just for the world at large, such an interesting experiment. Because the notion that, you know, to be sure that someone is there for your kids, you've reached this place where the whole family works really well together. But mm-hmm. it'd be so interesting to, I mean, not trying to upend your life, but it'd be interesting to flip it. So when you, and now you've got this great book.
Yes.
That I guess it said it'll launch what day?
The 18th.
The 18th, okay, September yep. 18th. Mm-hmm. And had you always had in your heart and mind to do a book?
I mean, why not? Absolutely, yeah. For sure. I mean, our house is full of cookbooks. I've been buying cookbooks and borrowing my parents' cookbooks for years and years and years.
So oh my gosh, what cookbook? You grew up with Julia Child, but what other?
For sure.
What cookbooks did you grow up with?
My mom, I mean, definitely the Mastering the Art of French Cooking, both of those. Craig Claiborne and Fanny Farmer, those were the ones that that my mom used a lot.
You had classics. And then in your collection, what are your favorites?
My favorites, I love Marcella Hazan's. She just, anything that you make out of there is the best whatever that you can possibly make.
Marcella Hazan, if you know, anyone who's listening doesn't know who she is, she was an Italian, and her cookbooks are so authentic. They're mm-hmm. so, they're really simple. Mm-hmm. They're really clear. And she was a longtime contributor to Food and Wine. Mm-hmm. And she was a big chain smoker and drinker, and which we always thought was so funny because, you know, her dishes are quite nuanced. Uh-huh. And her husband, Victor, would write the recipes and okay. write everything in her voice, which, again, the two of them were a real treat. And they would come to town and we would have sushi with them. So Marcella is a great touchstone.
Absolutely. For yeah. sure.
Is there any book on which you modeled your own or anything that inspired the book?
I think, so with our book, we really wanted it to be a really pure representation of the restaurant. We didn't want to put something out there that then you ate at the restaurant and you were like, what? Am I at the same place? Mm-hmm. I don't understand this. And I think, you know, something that's fun and really interesting about our book is that it's the whole story of how we met, how we fell in love, how we, you know, took a chance and moved to the West Coast. Everything you've been asking me about, opened, you know, this restaurant, had kids, and, you know, everything that has happened since. And so you don't just read a bunch of recipes and learn how to cook the food that we cook out of the restaurant. You get to, like, hear a story. And I think there are a lot of parts of that story that people can relate to. And people, maybe they haven't had the same experience, but they've done something similar that they are like, oh yeah, that's like when we decided to move to Chicago uh-huh. and, you know, whatever. It doesn't even have to be work in restaurants, but
it's in the story is so relatable and the recipes are pretty intense. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I look at them and I could do a component of something. Mm-hmm. What were you thinking of in terms of, because it is a beautiful reflection of the restaurant, and actually, so, you know, some cookbooks make me hungry. Some cookbooks make me want to cook. Some cookbooks make me want to just take them, you know, to bed and never leave. And you know, there are elements of those three things with your book. But I have to say, the greatest reaction that I had was, oh my God, I have to go back to that restaurant.
Oh,
I can't believe that it's been a while since either I've been in San Francisco or had a chance to visit the restaurant. And I'm like, I have to go back because the combinations of the ingredients mm-hmm. are so compelling, thoughtful, mm-hmm. but not predictable.
Yeah.
And as a cook reading it, and I'm like famously on the record for being a crappy cook, so it's okay. No, you know, it's like there are things in there that seemed above my level, and there's mm-hmm. things that seemed like at my level.
Yeah.
So what would you say for the, you know, more people on the hopeless vein, which would be me, what should they cook from the book?
I mean, I think you, like you said, there are definitely recipes that are more challenging. Like, I think our bread recipe is probably, it takes a lot of time. And, you know, there are a couple of dessert recipes. Like, I know our icebox pie recipe has many steps and many processes. But, like, for the desserts, we have some panna cotta recipes, or even, like, our olive oil cake is really simple and easy. And, like,
that, I love an olive oil cake.
That olive oil cake is delicious.
And what makes it special?
Well, in the book, it's because I caramelize it. So that takes it another step. And I explain you can completely leave that out of it if you just want to make an easy cake, that works. But if you want to do something a little special, you just dip it in some sugar and caramelize it in a pan. And so it gets a little crunchy, kind of like a creme brulee, except it's cake.
Well, I love a creme brulee cake. Mm-hmm. There's some pastries, like French pastries, that mm-hmm. seem like creme brulee. Well, not creme brulee, but like crusty, sugary, caramelly cakes.
I'm really into texture, and we have a lot of, I mean, Evan is as well. We sort of come from it from the same perspective. It's a really important part of what we do.
And contrasting texture or singular texture or?
I think contrasting. We like to add some sort of crunch to almost everything. Yeah.
And what's your favorite zone of crunch? Like, is it a crackery crunch
mm-hmm.
or?
Yeah, I think like a buttery, crackery crunch. For sure.
Interesting that when in thinking about the book, you go immediately to desserts. No surprise.
Yeah.
but I'm sure you had a hand in many of the savories as well. The steak.
Yeah, the steak is easy. Actually, the green bean chimichurri with the fried shallot, that's a go-to. Even to this day, sometimes I'll raid the walk-in and take a few steaks home. And, you know, with the green bean chimichurri, that's not hard to put together. And it's definitely delicious.
I feel like I could do that.
Yeah,
so,
for sure.
You have two kids. You cook every night at
yes.
home. Mm-hmm. I find that astonishing mm-hmm. because no chef ever has any food in the house. So mm-hmm. what food is in your house?
Oh, you know, we are all over the place. I'm not going to lie. We do have dino nuggets in our freezer.
What are those?
They are, chicken nuggets shaped like dinosaurs.
No way.
Yes.
I'm sorry.
That just shows. My children love them. I wish that didn't exist.
Wow.
But we have all sorts of things. You know, we actually have a really neat little pizza oven in our backyard, so we do that a lot. We have a lot of fruits and vegetables because it is California, and that is so easy to make happen. We also have a little garden in our backyard, so we've got stuff that we grab from there. I love a good steak, like I said. So you have
these beautiful tow-haired children.
Yes.
Adding motherhood, that's a piece of the exchange with your time, you know, moving over to pastry. But when you think about the challenges, like the kids are in the restaurant all the time,
mm-hmm.
I imagine. But was it hard to accept motherhood? I mean, it sounds like you've had a plan for a long time.
Yeah.
Kids were in that plan.
Yeah.
Always, you know, it seems. So it's, that part probably isn't such a distraction, but the identity as mother, like how does that feel?
Yeah. I mean, you never really know until you're experiencing it yourself, and everybody's perspective will be different. But for me, At some point, I knew I was ready to start thinking about starting a family, and you know, we eventually did. And
how did you know? How did you know it was time?
I just started looking at kids and saying, "I need one of those."
Wow!
Like, it was weird. I'd never had that experience before, and then all of a sudden, I would see babies and be like, "Yep, I need a baby." It was just like
so visceral.
Yes. And you know, I remember being pregnant and I was putting together our business plan. Evan wrote like the numbers, the spreadsheets, but I wrote the actual, you know, literature, the business plan. And I was pregnant in our tiny little apartment, putting that together and thinking about how we're going to do this. And I thought, okay, so we'll get a playpen and we'll put a playpen in the basement in the office. And then we can just have the baby in the playpen. I'll be upstairs with Evan working the line. Like, who, that is not a viable option. But I didn't know any better. I was like, I've never hung out with a baby. I thought, right, hey, you just put it in, you know, it'll be fine. It can't climb out. You know, then, you know, at some point we have this kid and it's like, oh my God, no, that is not going to work. How are we going to figure this out? And when we were doing the pop-ups, I would just take, his name is Van. I would take Van with us and carry, I would have him in like a little backpack to do prep. And then for service, I would have him in a baby Bjorn on my front and I would expedite, you know, and he'd be shuffling the tickets around and like, this isn't working either. But yeah, I mean, it definitely changed. It changed not just how I worked, but also who I was at work. You know, it I guess kind of softened me a little bit in a way.
In what way?
I mean, I definitely, like, when I was a cook, I had to learn how to be a lot tougher.
Do you think you had to? Do you think, like, if you did it today in this circumstance, you would have to?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. It's hard to say today. I think the environment in a kitchen is not quite as hostile as it was when I was working. So if you put me in, like, our kitchen, I don't think, I mean, you have to be tough just to get through service in general. But I don't think people are as hostile and difficult in kitchens, at least in our kitchen. But yeah, I definitely, I mean, I'm like a pretty shy, quiet person. When I moved to New York, I had people that laughed in my face and said, oh my God, you're never going to make it in New York. You know, it's going to eat you alive. And I had to fake it. Uh-huh. You know, I had to fake it. I had to figure out how to seem tough.
How'd you do that?
I was quiet. I put my head down and worked. I tried to be just as tough as the guys around me. And sometimes that meant acting like the guys around me, for sure. You know, for every drink they took, I took a drink. You know, like all
the And you hear about it all the time.
Yeah.
That's amazing. I don't, you know, I'm not totally naive, but it is incredible the expectations for everyone to behave the same way and how bad that behavior was.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
Hopefully that's changed. So softer when you came back with kid.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think, I'm a mom now, so I tend to have like kind of that motherly perspective towards everybody, which is maybe not always the greatest thing, but, that's just who I am. So.
And why wouldn't it be the greatest thing?
I don't know, because, you know, I'm the boss. Sometimes you gotta be the boss.
Right, separate the mom, right? Yeah, all that caretaking from. Yeah. But you didn't do it.
Yeah. So like, well, I have a friend who's a mom and a chef, and she told me once that she never takes her kid to the restaurant because she doesn't want her employees to see that side of her. And it just never even occurred to me to be that way. But I appreciate that, and there's a part of me that thinks, oh, maybe that is a good approach. But it's also just not authentically me, you know?
What do you think this is a huge problem throughout the industry, you know, women chefs with children because of childcare? Mm-hmm. Not that they can't do the job, it's the kids.
Yeah.
Do you have a suggestion solution for that?
I mean, I wish I did. I don't know. I mean, I know what works for me. It's having a husband and my own business so that we can figure that out. You know, like we can work a schedule out that works for both of us so that if I want to be there at night, I can be at the restaurant at night. If I want to be at home, I can be at home. And sometimes we can't, you know, like right now we're traveling a lot. My parents have to come out and watch the kids, or Evan's parents have to come out and watch the kids. And so it's never perfect. I honestly don't know how I would do it if I didn't have that support. For sure.
So it's something we have to work on.
Yeah.
Figure out the answer to that question because it's a big one. And what do you see the future? You have a book, you have two restaurants. I keep saying Rich Table, but there's also RT, Rotisserie, which I love, which is, you know, more quick service, delicious, robust food. Do you have other visions of things you'd want to do?
Oh my goodness. Every chef always has a million visions. We always want to do all sorts of things. I think, you know, we've tried to be really smart about how we expand or how we progress, because I think it's really easy for people to go too quickly and too aggressively, and we don't want to make that mistake. But I do think, you know, like RT Rotisserie is something that we could definitely expand and open more around the Bay Area or even beyond. So I think we're just now, that's a little over a year old, and we're just now starting to sort of think about that. But, you know, we always have other ideas for things.
That'd be great to have one in New York.
Yeah.
Last question. I always like to pay it forward. Is there a woman in the world of food that you think that people need to know about? And why?
I think my dear friend, Jessica Marr. She and I went to college together, and we ended up working at Boulay together, and she actually met her husband there. He was at the Danube, and we all started dating at the same time. And then she worked with me at Moss Farmhouse, and then she and her husband now live in Austin, Texas, and they have a restaurant. They have two little boys. They opened a second business a couple of years ago. It was like a cook's shop, cookbook shop. They sold
knives.
What's
the restaurant called?
Lenoir.
Okay.
But she is like my rock. She is we talk to each other all the time. And she is the one other woman in this industry that I just turn to more than anybody else for support, because we have so much in common. And we have, you know, she deals with running businesses, trying to figure out staffing, trying to figure out who's taking care of the kids. She's amazing.
Love that. Okay, well, with that, we're going to sign off from Speaking Broadly, but I can't end this show without thanking my amazing engineer, David Tatasciore, who's going on to bigger, I'm not going to say better, bigger, more different things, leaving me in the studio. There you go. Because how am I going to live without a special effects? We didn't find a special effect in the entire show. I was hoping to have one. And now, and that's his laugh.
And now I'm taking them with
me. Now we have it forever. Okay, well, I hope I sound the same to all of you next week. This is Dana Cowan. Have a really great week. You know where to find me if you want to DM me, FW Scout. On Instagram and Twitter. And if people want to follow you, you're a little cagey on Instagram.
Yeah.
But you can follow Rich Table, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Have a great week, everybody.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.